and wide-ranging list of cartels and suspected drug traffickers, you know, apparently including those who are not affiliated with an organization that's been designated as a terrorist organization. And even as, you know, the Trump administration has repeatedly asserted that these lethal strikes against suspected drug traffickers are on firm legal ground, they've kept OLC's legal reasoning secret. And we think that's a very serious problem, you know, given the life or death stakes of the president's use of force. And we think that the public really deserves to know how our government is justifying these strikes as lawful. And we think that it's really imperative that this transparency comes, you know, immediately. The public should be able to, you know, read the government's legal justifications right now while there's still, you know, an opportunity to stop these illegal and dangerous strikes and hold government officials accountable.
Well, so why are you forced to put in a FOIA request? What's the blockage there?
So the government has not disclosed its legal reasoning, even though, you know, members of Congress have asked various officials within the executive branch what they think the legal authority under which they are operating is. The Trump administration has not released this secret memo that we think, you know, the American people are entitled to read. And so that's why we've submitted a FOIA request and are demanding that transparency, which we think is a necessary precondition to holding government officials accountable.
Well, absolutely. And I'll just ask you finally, although it's too big a question to ask finally, but we've talked a lot on this show about the use of the war on terror and terrorism and the vagueness of that to green light sort of any and everything. If we're now going to talk about narco-terrorism and just allow that term into the language, it seems super meaningful that this is already an elision and an expansion. But then it seems super meaningful that when, for example, a guest on CNN brings up, well, hey, in this context, well, let's talk about NSPM7, where now the White House is saying terrorism now means, you know, folks who are anti-capitalist and folks who are anti-whatever we say they can't be anti. And now we know what it means to be designated a terrorist. So it's very meaningful to focus on how they're delineating that term. And I guess I just want to ask you, in the short time we have left, what would you ask journalists to be drilling down on and asking? Because in this case, a guest brought up, hey, you're talking about bombing boats in the Caribbean, but this could be used in Des Moines, you know, and the media response was, hey, let's go to commercial.
I think that what you've said really gets to the heart of our FOIA request. You know, we think that the public deserves insight into the full extent of the president's asserted authority to summarily kill civilians, you know, and that insight is especially necessary given some of the recent statements that you're alluding to by, you know, U.S. government officials saying that they may use lethal force against suspected drug smugglers or so-called terrorists in places other than on the high seas, including President Trump's statement that future strikes may occur on land, and, you know, the very concerning statements from Attorney General Pamela Bondi saying that the Trump administration intends to take the same approach with, quote-unquote, Antifa, which, as you're saying, the administration has called a domestic terrorist organization. You know, so given all of this, you know, rhetoric, we really think that it's vitally important for the government to disclose its legal reasoning and for the public to be able to interrogate that reasoning, given really the life and death stakes of these strikes.
All right. Well, we'll end it there for today. Jeffrey Stein is staff attorney with the ACLU's National Security Project. Thank you so much for joining us today on Counterspin, Jeffrey Stein.
Thanks for having me.
go to buy a ticket for a flight, you think the price is the price. But in fact, the airline is using lots of available information about you to present the highest price they think you will pay. Yes, airlines have always tweaked prices based on status or frequency of flying, but this is different. This is companies using information you didn't share with them, determining what they openly among themselves call your pain point, the maximum you will spend before you say, okay, I just won't see my mother this year. Some insist this is just the market at work, but what can we do if we decide it's actually an instance of using technology to do something because it can without adequate consideration of whether it should? Journalist Katya Schwenk has written for The Intercept, The Baffler, The American Prospect, among others. Her piece on this issue, co-authored with Luke Goldstein, was for The Lever, online at levernews.com. She joins us now by phone. Welcome back to Counterspin, Katya Schwenk.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Well, the current story on what is called surveillance pricing starts with airlines, but we understand that that's not the beginning and certainly not the end. But maybe some basic information on what this practice is and how it's not quite the same, as one defender had it, as a restaurant offering senior citizens a discount on Sundays. It's not quite that, yeah?
No, it's not. You know, the airlines and other people who use these kinds of pricing tools would like consumers to think that everyone's getting like their own personalized discount. But of course, we know that like if there is no set rate or baseline set fare, there's not really a way to get a discount on that fare. And that brings us to the world of surveillance pricing, which I've been looking into, where we're seeing more and more companies, and I think airlines are the best example of this, work with consultants and with, you know, technology firms that offer sort of AI-driven data analytics to sort of target and personalize prices on an ever more granular level. So looking at your browsing patterns, your consumer spending history, maybe other kinds of personal data we don't quite know, to tailor what price the airfare you might see, the price you might be seeing for other kinds of consumer goods to you specifically. And as you said, the idea behind this pricing strategy and why it's so popular among these companies is because they are trying to maximize the amount of money they can get any given consumer to pay. And we don't honestly know quite how widespread it is. We're starting to sort of get a glimpse at this in the airline industry, but it is, I think, quite a concern.
Well, you cite a Forbes study that says, for example, if we're talking about how this pre-existed, you know, just before a holiday weekend, when flights are filling up and people need to fly, airlines might use what used to be called, and is still called, dynamic pricing, to raise ticket prices by 5 times as what they might cost. So they're looking and saying, you need to fly right now, and so we're going to charge you more for it. And somehow that is presented as like building a better mousetrap or capitalism at work, whereas for a lot of us it feels like something else, something predatory.
Yeah, and you know, dynamic pricing goes actually back quite a long way. And again, is something that began with the airlines but has spread across industries. You know, the idea being that like if there is some event and suddenly this particular flight becomes very popular, the, you know, airlines will raise fares to sort of adjust for that heightened demand, which, you know, is why airfare might be really expensive if you're like flying to go see like the Olympics or some big event like that. But you can really see the rise of dynamic pricing as it sort of happens now among tech platforms like Uber and Lyft, who like have what they literally call on their consumer facing app surge pricing, you know, where these fares are fluctuating constantly according to demand. And what that's created is an environment where surveillance pricing is able to flourish because people are really used to a situation where there is no base fare. Right. Like, you don't know what your Uber is going to cost until you open the app. And when you're in that kind of environment, it's much easier for companies to tailor prices to consumers based on like their personal data.
So this is, lo and behold, a profit maximizing pricing system. But somehow there are folks who still insist that it's really just a fair system. And then some others that, if you look at it, they say it's really pro-consumer. You know, one particular table thumper that I read said that any consumer concerns are just ignorant pearl clutching because prices are a social language. And so if the price for a product or a service is too high, well, consumers will just reject it, you know, and that's the market at work. And I'm trying to see a vision of someone saying, well, I'll just find another way to get to my sister's wedding. You know, ha ha, the consumer speaks. Now you must lower your prices. That's just not the way that we see the market working. And yet that's kind of the narrative that we're being told to justify this practice.
Right. I mean, even if you are sort of a believer in the free market, the sort of like classical economics marketplace as the best option for consumers, that's not really what's going on here. I mean, when you have dynamic pricing in the way it's being used now, like as you said, consumers don't actually have very much choice in many of these circumstances. So it's not like they're able to choose a lower fare from a competitor often. And then at the same time, there's also sort of an absence of information where, again, like because consumers are unable to see the dynamic pricing at work, they're not able to adjust their choices to adjust for that. And then furthermore, like a lot of these platforms that use dynamic pricing, or perhaps not a lot of them, but we've seen instances where tech platforms that advertise pricing services, such as the real estate pricing platform RealPage, what it does is sort of centralize pricing information across a particular industry. In this case, it is like rentals. And what that does is it sort of leads to a kind of price collusion, where because you have sort of the centralized tech platform setting personalized prices across an industry, it's another way to like set prices, basically, where you can see that like RealPage and these pricing platforms in consolidated industries basically acted like they allow companies to collude and set prices much higher than they would in like sort of a traditional free market. So yeah, I think much of the narrative around this is really mistaken.
Well, the administration and profit-driven corporations benefit from public ignorance or just misunderstanding on this. And we can understand that we're going to be deluged with PR that tells us that this kind of pricing is a benefit to us, that this personalized pricing, you know, we hear them saying it, this is actually going to get you a cheaper rate. That means, you know, just a fortiori, we need transparency about what's going on, along with a public interest pushback. And we see it, you know, representative in Texas, Greg Kassar, is calling for a pushback on AI pricing, citing not just the price gouging that we're talking about with airlines and with rental cars, but also wage suppression. You know, and I would refer folks to, we had a conversation with Hatim Rahman about that angle on it. But we're in a fight about whether this is a good or something that should be questioned, and transparency would seem to be at the root of any conversation we're going to have about that.
Absolutely. And I think especially when, you know, under this current administration where we have like the consumer protection authorities or antitrust regulators that may have been well placed to take this on or like not doing their jobs or have been fired and basically prevented from doing their jobs, we're going to need other avenues toward transparency. And I know some lawmakers, as you mentioned, have been outspoken about this. But I mean, the reality is it's kind of like a wild west out there where I think many of these companies and airlines and, you know, everyone using these different pricing tools, they sort of know that they're not going to see very much accountability. And that's pretty scary.
In the absence of that kind of accountability, which of course we should continue to fight for, what do we as individuals do? I mean, I guess increased awareness, you know, if some AI is pushing a rate on you, you should compare and contrast as much as you can. What can we do as consumers?
Yeah, I mean, I think even in sort of the limited information environment we have, like it's good to remember that this is happening and to sort of always be looking out for it and keeping it in mind. But then, you know, I do think that public and consumer pressure is an important factor here. I mean, Delta, after announcing a few months ago that it was going to be using this AI or sort of implementing the next stage of this AI dynamic pricing or surveillance pricing software, it faced massive backlash from the public, enough that the airline said, we're not going to implement this program fully. We're not going to use this pricing software. I mean, does that mean Delta isn't using surveillance pricing? I mean, many of these airlines have been known to use these kinds of tools for years. So I don't know that that's true, but I think that, you know, to the extent that consumers are able to sort of use that kind of public scrutiny and public pressure to, you know, make sure companies are scared to implement these practices, I think that's still a good thing.
Right. And then finally, journalists, we would hope, would be kind of an arm of the public in demanding that transparency and accountability.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's something that we at The Lever have been writing quite a lot about, is all of the different industries that use these various kinds of pricing tools. So something we're keeping watch on, and, you know, we hope that others will be as well.
I've seen good reporting. I've seen reporting from a consumer angle. I guess what I'm looking for is the concerted pressure on the industry and on the government to what they're going to do in response. It's not that journalists are ignoring that this is impacting consumers. It's just the next stage where you talk about how do we change it that I feel like maybe they're falling down.
Yeah, I mean, there's quite a lot happening right now, and we don't have a particularly responsive federal government right now. But, you know, even so, it's important not to let these stories fall by the wayside and to continue asking questions about what is going to be done. And yeah, certainly something I'm thinking about.
All right, we'll end it there for now. We've been speaking with Katja Schwenk. Her piece, Airlines Are Using AI to Set Personalized Jacked Up Prices, which is co-authored with Luke Goldstein, is still online at levernews.com. Katja Schwenk, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Janine.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find shows and transcripts on our website, fair.org. The website is also the place to show much-needed support for the show, if you're able and so inclined. The show is engineered by Michael Cherry. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin.
Soul songstress, and you are listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, some outlets report that the White House designation of people in boats in the Caribbean, and now we understand in the Pacific, as drug smugglers, therefore unlawful combatants, therefore legitimate targets in the war on terror, therefore undeserving of due process, well, that raises legal questions. That's corporate news media speak for, We're going to wait till the White House comes up with some language we can report as making some kind of sense so we can pose it against everyone else who's saying what the actual hell is going on here. Even the resignation of the head of the U.S. Southern Command, which oversees U.S. military operations in Latin America, didn't seem to move corporate reporters beyond scratching their heads over how this bombing campaign might be legal, rather than discussing what tools we have to respond to wildly illegal actions by government officials. We'll talk with Jeffrey Stein, he's staff attorney with the ACLU's National Security Project, about efforts for minimally transparency on these lethal actions that look to be expanding by the day. Also on the show, when it comes to airlines and other companies mining your personal data to suss out how much you can possibly pay so they can charge you precisely that and no less, news media have a choice. They can write, like USA Today, about how AI might make airline pricing more complex. That's an explainer that explains that in answer to how airlines price tickets, quote, a shrugging emoticon is appropriate, close quote. And it ends with, no joke, trust your gut. Or you can do what our guest has been doing. Ask why industries are talking about saving consumers money with AI surveillance pricing, while at the same time telling their investors how they're maximizing revenue by pushing consumers to their pain point. How does that square? And who's standing up for consumers since it doesn't square? We'll hear from reporter Katya Schwenk on that story. That's coming up this week on Counterspin. Counterspin is brought to you by the Media Watch Group FAIR. So here's the top of this October 20th Reuters piece. Quote, when two alleged drug traffickers survived a U.S. military strike last week in the Caribbean, they left the Trump administration with a decision to make. Send them back home or find a way to keep them detained, close quote. There's already a lot going on there. Alleged drug traffickers, so not tried or convicted, and they survived, which means that other people not tried or convicted of drug trafficking were killed. In a military strike, okay, even if they're drug traffickers, why is the U.S. military doing the thing? And then in the Caribbean, so does the U.S. control that region? And after all that's been transmitted without friction in a single clause, we as readers are to interest ourselves in the matter of how the Trump administration can figure out a way to sell the action and the more like it we can presumably expect. The headline, in Trump's drug war, prisoners may be too much of a legal headache, experts say. Now this, things as they are, is not even the worst kind of piece. It poses questions anyway, but the questions are about how the administration might use the law more skillfully to address the complex set of legal and political problems experts say accrue when you kill people your country is not at war with and who have faced no judge or jury. Not everyone is waiting on the White House to puzzle up a new line to sell about why the U.S. military killing unconvicted foreign people on charges they will never see is not just okay, but as J.D. Vance puts it, the highest and best use of our military. Jeffrey Stein is staff attorney with the ACLU's National Security Project. Along with the Center for Constitutional Rights, they're pressing the administration for transparency on this. He joins us now by phone. Welcome to Counterspin, Jeffrey Stein.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, let's leap right into the moment. What is your FOIA request aimed at specifically, and then more broadly in terms of public awareness and potential resistance to these, let's call them extra legal Caribbean strikes?
Sure. Yeah. So as you just mentioned, since early September, President Trump has ordered, you know, at least 9 lethal strikes on private vessels in the international waters, reportedly killing up to 37 people. President Trump has claimed, without providing any evidence at all, that the victims of these strikes are quote-unquote terrorists, but the government's own disclosures indicate that the victims were, you know, as you were just saying, merely suspected of drug smuggling. You know, so put another way, you know, the government's own disclosures demonstrate that these strikes are, you know, not lawful. It's flagrantly illegal under both domestic and international law to summarily kill civilians who are suspected of committing crimes. And for this reason, members of Congress from across the political spectrum, former government officials who served in presidential administrations of both parties, you know, international bodies, and numerous civil society organizations have all agreed that these strikes, you know, constitute murder, pure and simple. Notwithstanding this, you know, broad bipartisan consensus, however, the Trump administration is claiming that these strikes are lawful. The president sent a notice to Congress earlier this month saying that he had unilaterally determined that the United States is in a non-international armed conflict with certain gangs and drug cartels that he has also unilaterally designated as terrorist organizations. He's also claimed, again, without any evidence, that the victims of these lethal strikes are, quote, affiliated with these organizations and are thus unlawful combatants against whom the United States may use lethal force. The problem is that even if the victims of these strikes, you know, were affiliated with drug cartels, and, you know, again, the government has not provided any evidence to support that claim, there's simply no plausible argument that the United States is in an armed conflict with drug cartels. And under international law, an armed conflict between a state and a non-state actor, you know, exists only if the non-state actor is an organized armed group that's engaged in protracted armed violence against the state. And that's simply not the case here. Nonetheless, you know, according to some recent media reports, the Department of Justice's Office of Legal Counsel, or OLC, an office whose opinions are treated as binding within the executive branch, they produced a memo that reportedly authorizes lethal strikes against a secret and wide-ranging list of cartels and suspected drug traffickers, you know, apparently including those who are not affiliated with an organization that's been designated as a terrorist organization. And even as, you know, the Trump administration has repeatedly asserted that these lethal strikes against suspected drug traffickers are on firm legal ground, they've kept OLC's legal reasoning secret. And we think that's a very serious problem, you know, given the life or death stakes of the president's use of force. And we think that the public really deserves to know how our government is justifying these strikes as lawful. And we think that it's really imperative that this transparency comes, you know, immediately. The public should be able to, you know, read the government's legal justifications right now while there's still, you know, an opportunity to stop these illegal and dangerous strikes and hold government officials accountable.
Well, so why are you forced to put in a FOIA request? What's the blockage there?
So the government has not disclosed its legal reasoning, even though, you know, members of Congress have asked various officials within the executive branch what they think the legal authority under which they are operating is. The Trump administration has not released this secret memo that we think, you know, the American people are entitled to read. And so that's why we've submitted a FOIA request and are demanding that transparency, which we think is a necessary precondition to holding government officials accountable.
Well, absolutely. And I'll just ask you finally, although it's too big a question to ask finally, but we've talked a lot on this show about the use of the war on terror and terrorism and the vagueness of that to greenlight sort of any and everything. If we're now going to talk about narco-terrorism and just allow that term into the language, it seems super meaningful that this is already an elision and an expansion. But then it seems super meaningful that when, for example, a guest on CNN brings up, well, hey, in this context, well, let's talk about NSPM 7, where now the White House is saying terrorism now means, you know, folks who are anti-capitalist and folks who are anti-whatever we say they can't be anti. And now we know what it means to be designated a terrorist. So it's very meaningful to focus on how they're delineating that term. And I guess I just want to ask you, in the short time we have left, what would you ask journalists to be drilling down on and asking? Because in this case, a guest brought up, hey, you're talking about bombing boats in the Caribbean, but this could be used in Des Moines, you know, and the media response was, hey, let's go to commercial.
I think that what you've said really gets to the heart of our FOIA request. You know, we think that the public deserves insight into the full extent of the president's asserted authority to summarily kill civilians, you know, and that insight is especially necessary given some of the recent statements that you're alluding to by, you know, U.S. government officials saying that they may use lethal force against suspected drug smugglers or so-called terrorists in places other than on the high seas, including President Trump's statement that future strikes may occur on land. And, you know, the very concerning statements from Attorney General Pamela Bondi saying that the Trump administration intends to take the same approach with, quote-unquote, Antifa, which, as you're saying, the administration has called a domestic terrorist organization. You know, so given all of this, you know, rhetoric, we really think that it's vitally important for the government to disclose its legal reasoning and for the public to be able to interrogate that reasoning, given really the life and death stakes of these strikes.
All right. Well, we'll end it there for today. Jeffrey Stein is staff attorney with the ACLU's National Security Project. Thank you so much for joining us today on Counterspin, Jeffrey Stein.
Thanks for having me.
Go to buy a ticket for a flight. You think the price is the price, but in fact, the airline is using lots of available information about you to present the highest price they think you will pay. Yes, airlines have always tweaked prices based on status or frequency of flying, but this is different. This is companies using information you didn't share with them, determining what they openly among themselves call your pain point, the maximum you will spend before you say, okay, I just won't see my mother this year. Some insist this is just the market at work, but what can we do if we decide it's actually an instance of using technology to do something because it can without adequate consideration of whether it should? Journalist Katya Schwenk has written for The Intercept, The Baffler, The American Prospect, among others. Her piece on this issue, co-authored with Luke Goldstein, was for The Lever, online at levernews.com. She joins us now by phone. Welcome back to Counterspin, Katya Schwenk.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Well, the current story on what is called surveillance pricing starts with airlines, but we understand that that's not the beginning and certainly not the end. But maybe some basic information on what this practice is and how it's not quite the same, as one defender had it, as a restaurant offering senior citizens a discount on Sundays. It's not quite that, yeah?
No, it's not. You know, the airlines and other people who use these kinds of pricing tools would like consumers to think that everyone's getting like their own personalized discount. But of course, we know that like if there is no set rate or baseline set fare, there's not really a way to get a discount on that fare. And that brings us to the world of surveillance pricing, which I've been looking into, where we're seeing more and more companies, and I think airlines are the best example of this, work with consultants and with, you know, technology firms that offer sort of AI-driven data analytics to sort of target and personalize prices on an ever more granular level. So looking at your browsing patterns, your consumer spending history, maybe other kinds of personal data we don't quite know, to tailor what price the airfare you might see, the price you might be seeing for other kinds of consumer goods to you specifically. And as you said, the idea behind this pricing strategy and why it's so popular among these companies is because they are trying to maximize the amount of money they can get any given consumer to pay. And we don't honestly know quite how widespread it is. We're starting to sort of get a glimpse at this in the airline industry, but it is, I think, quite a concern.
Well, you cite a Forbes study that says, for example, if we're talking about how this pre-existed, you know, just before a holiday weekend, when flights are filling up and people need to fly, airlines might use what used to be called, and is still called, dynamic pricing to raise ticket prices by 5 times as what they might cost. So they're looking and saying, you need to fly right now, and so we're going to charge you more for it. And somehow that is presented as like building a better mousetrap or capitalism at work, whereas for a lot of us, it feels like something else, something predatory.
Yeah. And, you know, dynamic pricing goes actually back quite a long way. And again, is something that began with the airlines but has spread across industries. You know, the idea being that, like, if there is some event and suddenly this particular flight becomes very popular, the, you know, airlines will raise fares to sort of adjust for that heightened demand, which, you know, is why airfare might be really expensive if you're like flying to go see like the Olympics or some big event like that. But you can really see the rise of dynamic pricing as it sort of happens now among tech platforms like Uber and Lyft, who like have what they literally call on their consumer facing app surge pricing, you know, where these fares are fluctuating constantly according to demand. And what that's created is an environment where surveillance pricing is able to flourish because people are really used to a situation where there is no base fare. Right. Like, you don't know what your Uber is going to cost until you open the app. And when you're in that kind of environment, it's much easier for companies to tailor prices to consumers based on, like, their personal data.
So this is, lo and behold, a profit-maximizing pricing system. But somehow there are folks who still insist that it's really just a fare system. And then some others that, if you look at it, they say it's really pro-consumer. You know, one particular table thumper that I read said that any consumer concerns are just ignorant pearl clutching because prices are a social language. And so if the price for a product or a service is too high, well, consumers will just reject it. You know, and that's the market at work. And I'm trying to see a vision of someone saying, well, I'll just find another way to get to my sister's wedding. You know, ha ha, the consumer speaks. Now you must lower your prices. That's just not the way that we see the market working. And yet that's kind of the narrative that we're being told to justify this practice.
Right. I mean, even if you are sort of a believer in the free market, the sort of like classical economics marketplace as the best option for consumers, that's not really what's going on here. I mean, when you have dynamic pricing in the way it's being used now, like as you said, consumers don't actually have very much choice in many of these circumstances. So it's not like they're able to choose a lower fare from a competitor often. And then at the same time, there's also sort of an absence of information where, again, like because consumers are unable to see the dynamic pricing at work, they're not able to adjust their choices to adjust for that. And then furthermore, like a lot of these platforms that use dynamic pricing, or perhaps not a lot of them, but we've seen instances where tech platforms that advertise pricing services, such as the real estate pricing platform RealPage, what it does is sort of centralize pricing information across a particular industry. In this case, it is like rentals. And what that does is it sort of leads to a kind of price collusion, where because you have sort of the centralized tech platform setting personalized prices across an industry, it's another way to like set prices, basically, where you can see that like RealPage and these pricing platforms in consolidated industries basically act as like they allow companies to collude and set prices much higher than they would in like sort of the traditional free market. So yeah, I think much of the narrative around this is really mistaken.
Well, the administration and profit-driven corporations benefit from public ignorance or just misunderstanding on this. And we can understand that we're going to be deluged with PR that tells us that this kind of pricing is a benefit to us, that this personalized pricing, you know, we hear them saying it, this is actually going to get you a cheaper rate. That means, you know, just a fortiori, we need transparency about what's going on, along with a public interest pushback. And we see it, you know, representative in Texas, Greg Kassar, is calling for a pushback on AI pricing, citing not just the price gouging that we're talking about with airlines and with rental cars, but also wage suppression. You know, and I would refer folks to, we had a conversation with Hatim Rahman about that angle on it. But we're in a fight about whether this is a good or something that should be questioned, and transparency would seem to be at the root of any conversation we're going to have about that.
Absolutely. And I think especially when, you know, under this current administration where we have like the consumer protection authorities or antitrust regulators that may have been well placed to take this on or like not doing their jobs or have been fired and basically prevented from doing their jobs, we're going to need other avenues toward transparency. And I know some lawmakers, as you mentioned, have been outspoken about this. But I mean, the reality is it's kind of like a wild west out there where I think many of these companies and airlines and, you know, everyone using these different pricing tools, they sort of know that they're not going to see very much accountability. And that's pretty scary.
In the absence of that kind of accountability, which of course we should continue to fight for, what do we as individuals do? I mean, I guess increased awareness, you know, if some AI is pushing a rate on you, you should compare and contrast as much as you can. What can we do as consumers?
Yeah, I mean, I think even in sort of the limited information environment we have, like it's good to remember that this is happening and to sort of always be looking out for it and keeping it in mind. But then, you know, I do think that public and consumer pressure is an important factor here. I mean, Delta, after announcing a few months ago that it was going to be using this AI or sort of implementing the next stage of this AI dynamic pricing or surveillance pricing software, it faced massive backlash from the public, enough that the airline said, we're not going to implement this program fully. We're not going to use this pricing software. I mean, does that mean Delta isn't using surveillance pricing? I mean, many of these airlines have been known to use these kinds of tools for years, so I don't know that that's true, but I think that, you know, to the extent that consumers are able to sort of use that kind of public scrutiny and public pressure to, you know, make sure companies are scared to implement these practices, I think that's still a good thing.
Right. And then finally, journalists, we would hope, would be kind of an arm of the public in demanding that transparency and accountability.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's something that we at The Lever have been writing quite a lot about, is all of the different industries that use various kinds of pricing tools. So something we're keeping watch on, and you know, we hope that others will be as well.
I've seen good reporting. I've seen reporting from a consumer angle. I guess what I'm looking for is the concerted pressure on the industry and on the government to what they're going to do in response. It's not that journalists are ignoring that this is impacting consumers. It's just the next stage where you talk about how do we change it that I feel like maybe they're falling down.
Yeah, I mean, there's quite a lot happening right now, and we don't have a particularly responsive federal government right now. But, you know, even so, it's important not to let these stories fall by the wayside and to continue asking questions about what is going to be done. And yeah, certainly something I'm thinking about.
All right, we'll end it there for now. We've been speaking with Katja Schwenk. Her piece, Airlines Are Using AI to Set Personalized Jacked Up Prices, which is co-authored with Luke Goldstein, is still online at levernews.com. Katja Schwenk, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Janine.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find shows and transcripts on our website, fair.org. The website is also the place to show much-needed support for the show, if you are able and so inclined. The show is engineered by Michael Cherry. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin.
Halloween. But let's take off our masks this time and show ourselves true.
WRCT Pittsburgh. It's more fun when it doesn't make any sense.
Thank you. Idaho, a teacher was recently forced to take down a poster in her classroom that said, "Everyone is welcome here." They said that was a divisive political statement. And you know what? From the fascist point of view, that is a divisive political statement, because their goal is to ensure that everybody is not welcome.